particularly sharp-eyed for mentions of women pilots, studying their exploits as though reading tea leaves. She didn't idolize them the way she did male pilots, but envied them with a rawness that sometimes curdled into dislike. The obligatory photos of them powdering their noses in the cockpit disgusted her, and the fuss around Amelia Earhart, who was given credit for being the first woman to cross the Atlantic by air, even though she'd merely been a passenger on the Friendship, baffled and annoyed her. You might as well celebrate a sack of ballast. She preferred Eleanor Smith, who'd gotten her license at 16 and at 17 flew a Waco 10 under the Queensboro, Williamsburg, Manhattan, and Brooklyn bridges on a dare. There she was in all the newspapers afterward, powdering her goddamn nose. Next, Eleanor had set a record for solo endurance flying. Nearly 13 and a half hours, and after someone broke it, she set a new one. 26 and a half hours in a big Belanca pacemaker. After that, she set a women's speed record, 190.8 miles per hour. What kind of books? Trout said. You know, by pilots, about pilots. Proudly, I read one about the theory of flight. What did that one say? It was about Isaac Newton and lift and Bernoulli's principle, that sort of thing. Bernoulli's principle? Trout said. Never heard of it. What's it say? Marion, who had intended only to make a breezily knowing allusion, climbed up on the landing gear strut and peered through the side window into the cockpit. The long fuselage was empty except for two wicker seats bolted to the floor side by side at the controls. It's hard to explain, but it has to do with how the air pulls the plane upward. She hoped he wouldn't press. Well, I've been flying a long time, and I've never heard of it. He set aside the newspaper and got to his feet as she hopped off the strut. He only came to her shoulders, but he looked strong, sturdy. He said, "You want to go up or just stand around drooling? It's a good day for it." For a moment, she stared fiercely at the plane. Then she said, "I have money. If you'd be willing to teach me a few things, I can pay you for a lesson." Hands in his pockets, he grinned, showing all his frightful yellow teeth. "Good for you. Money's a useful thing. But this'll be free of charge. She's already fueled up. I just need you to help me roll her out." For such a large machine, the plane moved easily. They each took a side and pushed a wing strut as though leaning into a plow, emerging into the bright day. Marion's body coursed with so much adrenaline she felt translucent. Here was her teacher. He had arrived, as she'd known he would. "You know how to do a walk around?" he said, shading his eyes and looking up at her. "Only in theory." "Like Berwatzit's theory?" "This one's pretty simple. You give the plane a good looking over and make sure there's no holes in it and no oils leaking out nowhere. You check the tires, that's about it." The travel air proved to have no obvious holes or leaks, so Trout opened the cabin door down near the tail and told Marion to go sit in the seat on the right. "Starboard," she said.
"Oh-ho! We've got a regular bear who's it on our hands."
She had to stoop as she walked up the cabin's sloping floor. The inside smelled of gasoline. Bolt holes on the floor showed where more seats could go, but there were only canvas straps and metal hooks. "You fly a lot of cargo?"
"Some," he said, climbing in after her.
Once they had settled in, an elbow-to-elbow squeeze, even for a small man and a skinny girl, he pointed out instruments set into the dash.
"There's your fuel gauge, your compass, your altimeter, your tachometer, your oil pressure, your clock.
I know what a clock is.
You're a damn genius. There's your airspeed indicator, your rate of climb indicator."
He showed her the levers, the pedals, the twin steering wheels yoked together, the crank up above their heads that adjusted the horizontal stabilizer, the brakes that could only be operated from his side.
"You don't have to remember everything right this minute," he said.
But she did remember. Never before had she ridden in a plane that didn't require someone to swing the propeller. An electric motor got the flywheel spinning. The engine caught. A cloud of smoke billowed and dissolved. A few sputtering bursts became the uneven rattle of pebbles shaken in a can, then the impatient waltz beat of a galloping horse, then a steady, metallic panting. The propeller blurred.
"It would be better to learn in a biplane to get the basics," Trout shouted over the noise, "but I don't have one at the moment. Anyway, the idea is the same."
He had her operate the rudder as they taxied, feel the awkward yaw of the plane on the ground. At the end of the field, Trout paused to check the gauges and stick a wad of tobacco in his lip before he pushed the throttle forward. They jolted and rolled, picked up speed. Marion sensed the buoyancy in the plane, the way the tires dug less and less deeply into the grass. The fuselage tipped level as the tail wheel lifted. Trout pulled back on the yoke, and the plane parted from the ground.
"All right, now I'm easing off," he said.
He pushed his wheel slowly forward.
"She can get off steeper than that, but there's no need here. In the mountains, you've got to be sharper, but here we've got nothing but room."
Below on the valley floor were the hangars, the cruciform shapes of a few biplanes moored on the grass, the fairground's long barns and oval racetrack. Trout adjusted the throttle, cranked the stabilizer. A new fear struck her. What if she had no aptitude for flying? Her vision of herself as a pilot had been so convincing, she'd forgotten she didn't actually know how to fly, that she would have to learn. For the first time, the magnitude of her decision to leave school worried her.
"Okay," Trout said, "take over."
"What do I do?"
"Just try to stay straight and level."
This proved more difficult than it sounded, and she had to keep adjusting the controls according to Trout's instructions. There was a pervasive strangeness to being in the air, worked upon by invisible forces, struggling always for levelness. The plane was alive. The air was alive. Below, her city was alive too, but in the incomprehensible way an anthill is alive, full of minuscule, pointless activity.
"Want to try a turn?" Trout said. "You take the wheel, and I'll manage the rudder."
"I can do both."
"It's tricky."
"I know what a coordinated turn is."
"Knowing and doing are two different things, but if you say so, go right ahead."
Her fear was gone. There was no room for it. She pressed with her right foot, turned the wheel slowly to the right, felt for balance. The plane banked and turned. Of course it did. It was made to be flown. The controls controlled. But still, the fact that she had told an airplane what to do and it had obeyed seemed momentous. Her side window filled with the dark coils of the bitterroot, the tops of trees. From the ground, the pattern of it all was invisible. How the river fell along the valley in casual bends like a tossed fishing line. How the water always fused back together after being split and spliced by sandbars. Vantage brought obscurity, too, though. Detail was lost, the world reduced to patchwork. All trees were the same. Fields looked uniformly flat and green.
"A little more rudder," Trout said. "You feel it slipping?"
He spat tobacco juice into a coffee can. As soon as she had the plane zipping along level, mountains would loom up and she would have to turn again, flying around the valley like a marble riding the inner surface of a bowl. When they were back on the ground, engine off and propeller stopped, just shy of the hangar, Trout said,
"You're a natural."
Joy. Only joy. He could not have known he was saying the words she most wished to hear. "I am," she said, hoping he would elaborate.
"I've taught worse."
He motioned her out. Now that she had flown it, the travel air looked different. She knew the feel of the wheel and the pedals, the rhythmic kick of the engine as the sparks fired, the look of an orange wingtip pointing down at the river as she pivoted around it. She'd been concentrating too hard to fully absorb the miraculous fact that she, Marion Graves, was piloting a plane. But now, remembering, she got lightheaded.
The thing about flying, Trout said, is that it's unnatural. You've got to train yourself not to follow your instincts, but to build up new instincts instead. For example, the simplest example, say the plane stalls and you're losing altitude. What do you do?
Push the stick forward, dive to get speed back. He nodded.
You've read about it in a book, but it's different up there. When it happens, the last place you want to go is down, but you've got to do it. You have to aim the nose just where you don't want to go and go there. Getting a pilot's mind takes a long time. You've got to be patient, and you've got to have nerve. When you're up there, you can't get flustered and stop flying.
I know.
No, you don't. You can't. Not really.
Was he about to tell her she should give up? Even though he'd just called her a natural, had he identified some fundamental inadequacy in her? The whole valley seemed silent. No wind, no bird song. Finally, he said,
"So what do you say?"
Her mouth was dry. "About what?"
"You want to keep flying?"
For a moment, she wasn't sure she could answer.
"If you just tell me what you charge, I'll find a way of paying it."
Trout beamed up at her, his droopy eyes scrunched almost closed by the upward curve of his long mouth.
"I have good news for you. Great news. So good, you won't even believe it."
He paused dramatically. "Believe what?"
"There's someone who wants to pay for your lessons. You won't have to pay a dime."
For a moment, her disorientation was complete. But just as quickly, it cleared, replaced by certainty. "No," she said.
The big fish mouth arced downward. "What do you mean, no?"
"No."
"Marion."
He reached for her shoulder, gave her a gentle shake.
"This is good news. You've got a benefactor."
"Who is it?"
"As a matter of fact, this person would rather stay anonymous."
"Barclay McQueen."
Trout's face locked up tight. "I don't know that name."
"There's no one else it could be."
"No.
I have to pay my own way."
"I'm afraid that's not possible."
Trout looked genuinely regretful. "Isn't my money as good as Barclay's?" Of course it wasn't.
"I don't know who you mean."
"He can't have thought I wouldn't guess. There's not a whole crowd of people fighting to pay for things for me. Only one's been offering lately."
"Why not just enjoy the gift then?"
She turned away. "Nice meeting you. Thanks for the lesson." Trout put up his hands.
"All right. He said you might not accept his offer at first, but he also said you'd come around."
Marion thought for a minute. "He owns the plane, doesn't he?"
"Technically, Mr. Sadler does, so I'm afraid I can't let you pay for your own lessons."
"If it were my plane, I would. If I had a plane like this, I'd do a lot of things." He seemed to be getting even smaller as he spoke, hunching into himself. Abruptly, he went striding off toward the hangar, short legs working furiously. Marion didn't follow. She wanted to be alone with the plane. The engine was still giving off heat and the smell of oil. She bowed her head, rested one hand on the propeller as though it were the lid of a coffin. If Barclay had really wanted to be generous, he would have put his plane in her path and allowed her to pay Trout something reasonable for instruction, and to become a pilot under a blissful illusion of self-sufficiency. But no, he wanted her to know she was beholden. Why exactly, she didn't know, but she knew enough to be wary.
"They're not cold," Trout said from behind her. He was holding two beer bottles from the basket she'd delivered. "But after a first flight, you need something to celebrate."
She took one. "Thanks."
"Pull up some grass," he said, sitting down.
She sat cross-legged beside him. The beer was warm and malty.
"I remember what it was like," he said, "wanting to be a pilot."
The low sun glinted off the plane. "All along," she said, "when no one would give me lessons, I was sure it was because my teacher hadn't come yet. I thought he'd just show up one day, fly into town the way the first pilot I ever knew did. So when you said you'd take me up,"
she took a morose swig. "Why not just let things happen the way he wants? I get paid, you get to learn. He gets to be your patron. Everybody's happy."
"He's not doing this out of the goodness of his heart." The band of reflected sunlight on the plane narrowed and disappeared. The air began to cool.
"Maybe this is like what I was saying about flying," Trout said quietly, picking at the grass. "Maybe you have to go against your instincts. You want to pull away, but you'll only get through if you do the opposite."
"I should do the opposite of pulling away from Barkley?" She looked at him hard. He couldn't hold her gaze, lifted his hands again.
"None of this is any of my business, but I think he means well."
He glanced back at her.
"Don't you?"
"I really have no idea."
"Can I level with you, Marion?"
"Sure."
Trout cleared his throat, stretched his mouth in a wide grimace. "You'd be doing me a big favor. He's gotten it into his head that I should teach you to fly. I'm a good teacher, I promise. And I do other flying for him. Transport flying, up north. You follow?"
"Of course." No wonder there were no seats for passengers. The plane was for bringing liquor from Canada.
She shook her head at her own slowness. "No," he said.
"No, I follow. I just feel stupid."
He pointed the butt of his bottle at the plane. "You can put skis on it, handy for winter. You can put on floats and land on water. What I bring back is only a drop in the bucket, but your friend is smart enough to know that you get enough drops and pretty soon you've got a full bucket."
Skis.
She momentarily forgot her crisis, so thrilling was this idea.
"You land on skis?"
"Learn to fly with me, and you will too."
Here was a new image to ponder and burnish. Herself swooping the travel air low over a smooth white plain, sending up rooster tails of powder as she landed.
"I've got a wife and kids. I'd owe you a big one." He offered a sad twist of his long lips. From inside his jacket, he pulled a notebook and a pencil and handed them to her. "Here, you keep track of your flights in it."
The logbook's pages were ruled, and there were headings for date, aircraft, aircraft number, engine type, weather, duration, and notes. Trout handed her the pen.
"Go on and fill out the first line."
When she paused at duration, he said,
37 minutes. Then put instruction under notes. "Geez, you have terrible handwriting."
She tried to hand the logbook back to him, but he said,
"No, it's yours. Keep it. And I almost forgot. I'm supposed to tell you happy birthday."
"It was yesterday," she said. She and Jamie were 15. Marion drove from the airfield to the green and white house. She knocked at the front door, kept knocking until Sadler opened it.
"He's not here," he said.
"You tell him," Marion said. "I have a condition."
"Oh?"
"When I'm qualified, I'll go to work for him flying across the line. I don't need charity." He won't agree.
That's fine, Marion said, because, like I told him, I never wanted to fly anyway.
They stared at each other, and she intuited how much Sadler disliked her for complicating his duties.
None of it was her fault, she wanted to say. Barclay could have just left her alone.
You'll tell him?
Sadler rubbed his cheek as though testing his shave. You want my advice? The question exhausted Marion.
How should I know if I do without getting it?
He studied her for a long moment, said, I'll tell him. He shut the door.
As she drove back to Stanley's, she pressed on the accelerator.
The boxy old delivery truck swayed around the turns. Giddily, she imagined pulling back on the steering wheel, feeling the tires part from the road.
Barclay would agree. She knew in her gut he would.
He wouldn't mean it, would have some plan for going back on his word, but she wouldn't let him. She was going to learn to fly, and then she was going to go to work as a pilot. A force was pressing up from under her.
Lift. It was lift.
Manifest, manifest. 6. Once, when I was 15 and on hiatus from Katie McGee, my dirtbag friend Wesley and I liberated Mitch's Porsche in the middle of the night so we could drive out to the desert to drop acid and watch the sunrise. We'd had visions of lying on boulders under the starry sky, but it was freezing and windy, and we ended up sitting in the car with the heater on. Once the drugs kicked in, I didn't like how his face looked. I kept trying to focus on anything except him, but his horrible face kept looming closer and closer, gray and papery and blank, as though someone were shoving a wasp nest at me. Dawn had been a red slit, night sliced open with a scalpel, with the bristly silhouettes of Joshua trees raising their clubbed arms against it. When I came back, Mitch, who was in one of his periods of sobriety, was lying out by our pool with the newspaper. Where's my carbon? He asked when I flopped onto the chaise next to him. The desert, I said. Wesley and I wanted to watch the sunrise. It's not a big deal. How old is Wesley? I didn't answer. I didn't actually know. Mitch turned a page of the paper. After a while, he said quietly, Do you think you might be getting a little out of control? Ordinarily, I would have bristled at his hypocrisy. But because he asked with what seemed like genuine curiosity, like he didn't already know the answer, and because I'd never expected him to ask at all, and because I'd gone to the desert looking for awe and come away with terror, I said, I don't know. Maybe. He turned another page. You don't need to do this wild phase, you know. You could just skip it. But I did need to. I didn't see another way. I needed to spring jab out into my life like a switchblade. You only live once, I said. Gwendolyn didn't leak it, the sex tape, but I still got fired. I got fired so quickly I couldn't help but be impressed by the swiftness of her vengeance. Gavin Dupre called me himself. Do you know who this is? He said. Yes, I said. Do you know why I'm calling? His voice was quiet, ratcheted so tight it was a miracle any sound was escaping him at all. I have a guess. Gwendolyn is threatening to leak a sex tape of you and Oliver unless I fire you. Do you know where she says she got it? From me? That's right, from you. So you see, I'm in a difficult situation here, Hadley. What would you do if you were in my position? If you'd given an actress the chance of a lifetime and she'd repaid you by being staggeringly ungrateful and disrespectful? If I were you, I said, and I can't pretend to know you all that well, but from what I do know, I would probably offer some kind of bargain that involves sucking my dick again. He was silent. I recognized it as the horror movie silence that precedes someone jumping out of the shadows and stabbing you to death. Finally, he said, I don't know what you're talking about, and if you were to make any such slanderous insinuations publicly, you would find yourself on the receiving end of a very damaging and protracted lawsuit that would expose everything and everyone you've ever done. But yes, you are fired, and I will make sure your career is over. You're finished. I turned off my phone and went into a windowless room downstairs in my house, a sort of Moroccan-themed screening room, and I lay on a big tasseled pillow and watched a show about a woman who fixed up decrepit old houses. She was tiny and strong and used a nail gun a lot. The houses always ended up with clawfoot tubs and wainscoting and subway tile. From the pictures I've seen from when I was a baby, my parents' house outside Chicago looked like one of her projects if she'd abandoned it halfway through. There's a photo of my mother bathing me in a clawfoot tub, but you can see the linoleum floor is peeling and discolored. In another, you can see nice wood floors, but also a sad-looking futon covered with a rumpled sheet. I don't know why they didn't fix it up nicer. They had some money, enough for the Cessna that killed them. I don't know if they wanted to live that way or just didn't want badly enough to change. Eventually, I fell asleep. By the next morning, the news was everywhere, spreading from The Hollywood Reporter to celeb gossip sites to CNN. Glee dolloped all over it like whipped cream. I had 3,000 Twitter notifications. Newsflash, I tweeted. Nothing lasts forever. Get over it. Then I deleted my account and turned off my phone. Of course, I'd meant to piss off Gwendolyn. To flaunt that I'd not only had what she most wanted, but had tossed it away. I'd known this was the probable outcome, but still I reeled like a charred and tottering cartoon knight who'd just been flambéed in dragon's breath. I was lying on the couch watching a different real estate show, one where unreasonable people shop for cheap houses in boring places, getting little endorphin rushes from random strangers making decisions, when Augustina reminded me I'd scheduled a session with my trainer. I was supposed to be getting in shape for the fifth movie, eating nothing but fish and kale, thinking only of my triceps. But that was irrelevant now.
You could cancel, Augustina said. He'd understand.
But I had to get out. I said I'd drive myself. MG rode shotgun. At the bottom of my driveway, I crept slowly, carefully, mindful of lawsuits, through my rookery. They filled my windows with their lenses. Their hands suctioned to the glass like starfish.
You want me to get them to move back?
MG said. He only speaks when absolutely necessary. Generally just hovers stone-faced in my vicinity. But I said no. It was okay. One photographer belly-flopped across the hood, shooting into my face. I made a big sideways sweeping motion at him, shouted, "Get the fuck off!" Even with the windows up, the shutters made a din. A swarm of robot insects, playing cards in bicycle spokes, 100 old film projectors running at the same time.
Manifest, my trainer said. Manifest.
I was supposed to look in the mirror and manifest, in my mind, the body I wanted. Holding weights, I leaned forward, bent my knees, opened my arms out and up. My trainer called it the butterfly. I tried to imagine the body I wanted, but all I saw was a butterfly struggling slowly through heavy, swampy air.
Engage your core, my trainer said. A while ago, I had a shrink, briefly, who told me to imagine a glowing tiger every time I doubted myself. To imagine the tiger was my source of strength, my essence. I was supposed to imagine the tiger glowing brighter and brighter, and a thick layer of dust settling on everything else until the whole world was gray except for my tiger. The tiger was like the vial of white light in that superhero movie. The tiger was preposterous. The tiger was me. The tiger was everything but me. Everyone knows Los Angeles is a city of deniers. Everyone knows this is a city of silicone and Restylane, of charismatic stationary bike preachers and kettlebell gurus, of healing crystals and singing bowls, of probiotics and juice cleanses and colonics and jade eggs you stick up your vag and exorbitantly expensive snake oil powder you sprinkle on your coconut chia pudding. We purify ourselves for life as though it were the grave. This is a city that's more afraid of death than any other. I said that to Oliver once, and he told me I was being a little negative. I said it to Siobhan, and she gave me the name of a shrink. I said it to the shrink, and he asked me if I thought people were wrong to fear death. I said I didn't think the fear was the problem as much as the struggle. I said I thought the struggle should be to accept death, not to defy it. He said. Imagine a tiger, he said. 7. I floated on a raft in my pool. I felt stunned, like a critter picked up by a bird of prey and then dropped, a beating heart inside an inert, sprawled body. The insides of my eyelids glowed blood orange. I must have fallen asleep, or almost, because when a very English voice called out, "You really shouldn't sleep in a swimming pool," I startled and tipped off the raft into a blue blur. The water stung and fizzed in my nose. "I didn't think you were actually asleep," Sir Hugo said when I surfaced. He was holding the half-empty bottle of scotch and two glasses and had a canvas tote bag over his shoulder. "Augustina let me in." I hauled myself out at the edge. "Are they still down there?" "The photogs? Oh, yes." I wrapped a towel around myself, and we sat at the table where I had once eaten ancient grain bowls with Alexei. Hugo poured the scotch. He held up his glass. "To an ending," I clinked. "Now, my girl," he said in a gentle growl, "what do you want to do? Will you take time off?" I imagined what I would do with time off. I would float in the pool, smoke weed, manifest the body I wanted, imagine my tiger, watch people renovate houses, wait for something to happen. It wasn't unappealing, but in rebuttal, the vision of myself holding an Oscar came back to me again, obliterating those laconic half-thoughts like a cartoon safe crushing a cartoon cat. I was on stage, raising the statue above my head, living out the default dream of everyone in Hollywood. My arm and shoulder looked perfectly toned. A theater of people was on its feet, even Gavin Dupre. Alexei was there too, looking wistful. "I'd rather move forward," I said. "Good." He paused for a second and breathed in so hard his nose flattened, signaling he was about to quote something. "Men at some time are masters of their own fates. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves, that we are underlings." Men are masters of their own fates. Women didn't fit the meter. They never do, man. I have something for you. It's out of print, so don't be careless with it.
He pulled a book out of his tote bag and handed it over. An old, slender hardback, with a mustard-colored dust jacket crumbling at the edges. On the front cover was an illustration of an airplane flying over the ocean, the sun behind it, and a few stretched-out shallow M's scattered around to suggest birds. The title was in elegant italics. The sea, the sky, the birds between. The Lost Logbook of Marion Graves. The smell of the Van Nuys Public Library came back to me, and I could almost feel the sweaty vinyl embrace of the beanbag chair in the children's reading corner. I've read this book. Hugo's box hedge eyebrows flew up. You have? Don't look so stunned. I read.
You do?
Ha ha. It made a big impression on me when I was a kid. Orphan solidarity, you know? Team raised by uncles. I thought it would be full of hidden messages, like tarot cards or something.
Ah, Hugo nodded.
I can imagine it. We, Hadley, the bibliomancer, consulting the text for signs and omens. It's the perfect sort of book for that, isn't it? Mostly cryptic bits and pieces. What did it tell you?
Nothing.
Yes, well, that's not surprising. Really, I'm most intrigued by the question of whether or not she intended it to be read at all. I think the fact that she left it behind at least suggests she couldn't bear to destroy it. What do you think?
I considered bluffing, but instead admitted, I don't remember it very well. I think I was 10 or 11 when I read it.
Reread it, and then read this. He took another book from the bag, a paperback. On the cover was a soft focus photo of the back of a woman's head as she gazed toward a silver airplane parked on a flat expanse of white. A fur collar stood up against her neck. Apparently, People magazine had used the words irresistible, dazzling, high wire in relation to it somehow. I read aloud, Wings of Peregrine, a novel by Carol Pfeiffer.
To be honest, it's, Hugo teetered his hand, not the best. It doesn't have the depth one wishes for, and the prose is sometimes quite dreadful. But it's the basis for this. From the tote bag, he took a sheaf of paper clamped together with a binder clip and tossed it onto the table. A script. Its title page was stamped diagonally with the name of Hugo's production company. The Day Brothers brought it to me with Bart Olufsen already attached to direct, he said. They've done something quite unexpected. Gone for almost a Coen Brothers vibe. A little antic, but not as dark. Just the tiniest bit camp, but still quite affecting, I think.
So many brothers. You don't have anything else in that bag, do you? No more homework?
He turned the empty bag upside down and shook it. Not a page.
I pulled the script closer. Peregrine, written by the Day Brothers, based on the novel Wings of Peregrine by Carol Pfeiffer. I knew about the Day Brothers, Kyle and Travis, blonde twins with Nazi haircuts who vaped on the red carpet. They weren't even 30, but had created a quirky, violent limited series for HBO set in Reno. They were having a moment. And Bart Olufsen had made one talky indie movie that was the darling of Sundance, and then, like, three superhero movies. So he was probably ready to do the reverse sellout. These people were considered cool, and working with them might make me seem cool.
Whose idea was this?
Hugo grimaced. It gets a little complicated. The days were commissioned by the son of the woman who wrote the book. That couldn't have been cheap. No, but they wouldn't have done it if they didn't like the project, which they do. The guy's name is Redwood Pfeiffer. He wants to be a producer, and he already knew the days from being young and hip and extremely rich. He's a Pfeiffer. What's a Pfeiffer? Like the Pfeiffer Foundation. Like the Pfeiffer Museum of Art. The father died, Redwood's father. His parents have been divorced for ages. Anyway, he died, and Redwood came into a major share of the family fortune. It's from oil, I think? Chemicals? Something ghastly. His mother, Carol, wrote this novel, and here's the really interesting part. His paternal grandmother not only published Marion's book in the 50s, but paid for her flight. The family's all knotted up with this story, and Redwood's a do-gooder-slash-creative type. Very enthusiastic. I got it then, what the racket was. So he's looking to be something other than rich and idle, and he thinks he's going to reinvent Hollywood. That's likely his basic plan, yes. There is no real inflection to his words, like how a general planning an airstrike might give an estimate of civilian casualties. A bit of businesslike hardness to forestall pity. There are always a bunch of these rich kids floating around L.A., riding on fortunes they didn't earn as though on litters borne aloft by the ghosts of their ancestors. They want to make good movies, they all say. Projects chosen for quality writing, compelling vision, original voice, etc. And not for their prospects in the Asian market. They want to reinvent something that doesn't want to be reinvented. To disrupt a system that's orders of magnitude more complex and predatory and fortified than they think. That's their plan. Hollywood's plan is to strip the flesh from their bones so slowly they won't notice at first. Tiny little bites, and then big ones at the end. But, to be fair, Hugo wanted to make good movies too. He just needed other people's money to do it. He's putting up all the money? I asked. Ah, no, but a good chunk. Frankly, with the locations and the airplanes and the CGI and all, it's a bit rich for our blood. So we took it to Sun God. Sun God Entertainment was backed by hedge funds and had ambitions to make movies that were too expensive to be indies, but not expensive enough to be worth the studio's time. They signed on, and now, perhaps, there is just the slightest overabundance of cooks in the kitchen. But I think it could work. With the right star, of course. He winked. We couldn't pay you much. How not much? Scale. And something on the back end. Siobhan's gonna love that. Screw Siobhan. You don't need the money. This is your moment to show the naysayers what you're capable of. He was making his voice extra sonorous, booming at me like I was a medieval army he was trying to rally to wipe out another medieval army advancing over some moor. What was I capable of? I didn't actually know. I pictured myself with the Oscar again. Did I deserve an Oscar? No. But who did, really? Manifest. Hugo clapped his hands on his thighs and stood up. Think about it. I walked him through the house. As he stepped out the front door, I said, I should tell you, Gavin Dupre has a grudge against me. It might be inconvenient. He's not involved. But still, he can do things. How do you know he has a grudge? Oh, I got that feeling yesterday when he told me he'd kill my career. His exact words were, I put on the raspy growl of a comic book villain and clenched one hand into a fist.
You're finished!
To my surprise, Hugo only laughed.
Do you know who the head of Sun God is?
Ted Lazarus, isn't it?
Do you know that Ted Lazarus and Gavin Dupre hate each other?
Vaguely.
Do you know why?
No.
Gavin fucked Ted's wife, so it's fine. Everything's fine. Everyone's already out to ruin each other.
He reached for my hand.
This will be a very good role for you, my dear. This will elevate you.
He kissed my hand with a loud smack and went striding off. While he waited for my gate to open, he squared himself up, then, between the parting panels, swept a low bow to the paparazzi, who cheered. 8. After Hugo left, I got in the bathtub and opened Marion's book. Editor's note. The document contained in the following pages, reader, has taken a most unlikely journey before settling, as it has, in your hands.
Very true, I thought.
In 1950, Marion Graves, an accomplished pilot and the author of this short tome, vanished along with her navigator, Eddie Bloom, while attempting to circumnavigate the globe longitudinally by way of both the North and South Poles. They were last seen in Queen Maudland, East Antarctica, when they refueled at Maudheim, the encampment of the Norwegian-British-Swedish Antarctic Expedition. From Maudheim, they were to have flown across the continent, passing over the South Pole to the Ross Ice Shelf, where lay the remains of the various bases built and used during Admiral Richard E. Byrd's Antarctic expeditions, all dubbed Little America. Though the bases were abandoned, more than enough cached gasoline would have been available to refuel the plane, the Peregrine, before Marion and Eddie embarked on their journey's final leg, bound for New Zealand. Tragically, after departing Maudheim, neither pilot, nor navigator, nor aircraft were ever seen again. For almost a decade, nothing was known of their fate. Most assumed the Peregrine had crashed somewhere in the pitiless Antarctic interior. Now, thanks to a remarkably fortuitous discovery, we know that Marion and Eddie indeed reached the Ross Ice Shelf. Last year, while conducting research as part of the Collaborative International Geophysical Year, scientists exploring the buried remnants of Little America 3 found not only the expected artifacts of Byrd's 1939 to 1941 expedition, but also an odd bundle of yellow rubber. They determined, to their great surprise, that it was the kind of aviation life preserver known as a Mae West, and it was wrapped carefully around Marion's handwritten journal containing her elliptical, fragmented musings from the flight. The manuscript of this very book. I'm afraid I cannot elucidate her reasons for leaving behind her journal, and, ominously, one of their two life preservers. Perhaps she weighed the odds of reaching New Zealand versus the odds of future visitors to Little America finding the book, and, disturbing to contemplate, found the latter more likely. It can be counted as a stroke of luck that the base was still in existence at all. Icebergs are continually breaking, or calving, from the Ross Ice Shelf, and half of Little America 4, a more recent encampment from 1946 to 47, has already been carried out to sea. As exciting as we may find the news that Marion's flight extended far beyond what was previously known, bringing her only 2,600 nautical miles short of a completed north-south circumnavigation, this revelation also carries with it a sad truth. Marion Graves and Eddie Bloom took off from Antarctica and were lost. Despite the fanciful theories some have put forward, we can be certain they lie together deep under cold and stormy waters, in a tomb without walls, a place that remains lonely beyond imagination, despite the thousands upon thousands who have made their final rest there. The offices of D. Wenceslaus and Sons have lately been the site of impassioned debates over whether or not Marion would have wished for this manuscript to be published without having a chance to edit and consider its text. Was the manuscript intended as a posthumous message in a bottle? Or was she turning her back on her own words? Admittedly, both in conversation before her flight and in the pages themselves, Marion expressed ambivalence to me about the idea of a readership. But, as I have argued to my colleagues, if she truly did not wish these pages to be read, why did she then not simply destroy them, as she could have so easily? We reached no consensus, and she left no instructions, only the journal itself, abandoned in a frozen, hostile place. What she left resembles less a book than a scaffolding for a future book. But I felt she would prefer it be published as is rather than having it shaped and prettified. Beyond simple corrections of spelling and grammar, I have left her writing unedited, as the risk of distorting her thoughts and intentions seemed to outweigh my own impulses toward tidiness. I am glad to have known Marion. I wish she were still with us, but I am grateful for her decision, long ago now in that desolate place, to leave behind a record of her final flight. While the record, like the flight itself, remains incomplete, at least it has brought us closer to the end. Though, as Marion points out in this text, a circle has no end. Godspeed. Matilda Pfeiffer, publisher, 1959.
An incomplete history of Marion's 15th and 16th years. September 1929 to August 1931. The same month Marion turns 15 and goes up with Trout for the first time, a test pilot takes off from an airfield in Garden City, New York. He is already known for speed records and stunting and long-distance flying, and in less than 13 years, he'll become much more famous after he leads 16 bombers in a bold daylight raid over Japan. Jimmy Doolittle makes one circle and lands. It's a brief flight, only 15 minutes, mundane except for the opaque hood over his cockpit, cutting him off from everything except the instruments. Flying blind, it's called. Some of his instruments are experimental, among them the Sperry gyroscopic artificial horizon. In its later form, a fixed airplane, U, is superimposed on a gimbaled sphere. The sphere is black below its middle and blue above, the Earth, the sky, and orients you to the planet. This object will make the future possible. Before, you didn't fly in bad weather, so there could be no scheduled flights. Not really. No reliable airlines, certainly. Male pilots took their chances. Lots of them died. Before, if you lost sight of the ground for long enough, you were probably toast. Fly into cloud, and you'd likely end up in a spiral, though you might not even realize what was happening until too late. Up, down, left, right, north, south, all of it a terrible tangle, dragging you out of the sky. Survivors described a state of terminal confusion. When Doolittle goes up with Sperry's invention, plenty of pilots, despite their many brethren who'd corkscrewed down to their deaths, don't believe such an instrument is necessary. Take offense even at the suggestion. The more cautious sorts keep a close eye on their indicators to make sure they aren't inadvertently turning. But if you get distracted and start a spiral, those indicators won't be much help. The lucky living, Trout among them, tell one another that dead pilots are dead because they didn't have the elusive, magical it. You have to fly by the seat of your pants, they say, meaning a real pilot feels the plane's every movement in his ass. But it's your inner ear, not your ass, that's the problem. And your inner ear is a liar. A man, blindfolded and spun slowly in a rotating chair, will think when the chair slows that it has stopped. When it has stopped, he will think it has begun to spin the other way. The mistake happens deep in his ear, among the tiny hair cells and drifting fluid inside the semicircular canals of the bony labyrinth. These are the minute, impossibly fragile internal instruments that detect the yaw, pitch, and roll of the human head. Wondrous little gizmos, to be sure, but poorly evolved for flight. Imagine a biplane. Left to its own devices, the plane will naturally begin to bank, slowly entering a balanced, insidious turn that a pilot can't always detect if the real horizon is obscured by darkness or cloud. Neither your ass nor your inner ear will bother to tell you about a balanced turn if you're in it long enough. And without help from the right instruments, you'll think you're flying along straight and level, but the airplane's nose will drop toward the earth. Its path will tighten, begin to describe a funnel. Presently, you will become aware that your airspeed has increased and altitude decreased, that the engine is whining and the guy wires singing, that the dials are moving and you're being pressed into your seat. And without an artificial horizon, you will conclude the plane is in a dive. Speed going up, altitude going down, not a turn. At this point, the airplane might be banked to vertical or beyond, might even be upside down. And when you pull back on the stick to bring up the nose, you will only tighten the turn further. It's called a graveyard spiral. Now, one of three things will happen. You will pop out the bottom of the cloud with enough time to make sense of where the ground is and to level the wings and pull out. Or the airplane will break apart under the stress. Or you will spin directly into the earth or ocean or whatever's there. With the right instruments, you have a fighting chance of leveling out even if the cloud goes all the way down and brushes the earth like the marabou hem of a diaphanous white robe worn by God. But getting right with the horizon isn't easy. The sky is full of traps and temptation. Pilots report that their instruments went haywire in cloud, though of course they didn't. The pilots' own bodies are lying, not the dials. Your inner ear gets comfortable in a spiral. Even after you've extricated yourself, when the instruments say you are flying straight and level again because you are, your ear begs to differ. You're the blindfolded man in the rotating chair. The fluid inside that labyrinth is still spiraling, and the tiny little sensory hairs insist you are too. Your ears beg you to throw the controls over to make the spinning stop. Sometimes pilots listen, put themselves right back into a spiral. An oblivion of mist hides the earth, the truth. It's difficult to believe the gauges, that array of soulless little dashboard windows, over the insistence of the body, which is as sure as you live and breathe that you are funneling down into death. But you're not. You're dizzy inside a cloud. That's all. The second month of Marion's 15th year, October, the stock market crashes. Black Thursday, Black Tuesday, all of it spiraling, things breaking apart. But Marion barely notices. Wall Street seems far away, and anyway, she is flying. From high enough up, the mountains in their blazing autumn dapple resembled lichen-covered rocks, bright and nubbly. And she imagines they are, in fact, only rocks, that she has been shrunk to the size of a gnat. What is the difference between her and a gnat, really? Relative to the distance between the planets? To the size of the sun? No, you can't go up every day, Trout says when she asks. Not too much too soon. You've got to give things time to sink in. Trout can't teach her every day anyway. He has to fly to Canada, pick up booze in some hamlet, fly it back over the line, land on some stubby landing strip hidden in the mountains. Men in fast cars will be waiting there to distribute his cargo to points unknown. The nation is thirsty. The nation wants to drink away its cares. If he's landing after dusk, the leggers will light up the strip with their headlights, make a small glowing green rectangle in the great shadowed nothing of the mountains. Marion keeps driving for Stanley. She nearly causes an accident when she steps hard on the brake while going around a corner, daydreaming it into a rudder. Practice is all she needs to be competent, Trout says. As far as being good, well, that comes down to a lot more practice, some natural ability, and a bucket of patience. To be great? Trout shrugs. Not everybody has it in them. She doesn't tell him she is determined to be the best. Probably he'd say there's no such thing, that she might as well be determined to be an actual bird. And even birds get lost or caught in bad weather, fly into things, misjudge their way into that last smash-up. After 6 lessons of an hour each, she solos. Trout believes it's better to solo sooner rather than later, so she won't build it up too much in her head. Just fly the same as always, he says. She goes up and is alone in the sky, but she is concentrating too hard to exalt. Trout's voice has lodged in her ear, pointing out her mistakes, keeping her company. She bounces her landing, and Trout waves her up again. She circles around, lines up, touches down a little long. The earth below, so dependable and stationary when she is standing on it, turns into a wobbly, tippy thing on final approach. He waves. Again. Go again. If you're going to do real mountain flying, Trout says, you have to be able to land on half a dime. Otherwise, you'll roll off a cliff or plow into the trees. When am I going to do real mountain flying? She asks, feigning impatience, though she knows she isn't remotely ready to land anywhere except on a flat runway with plenty of open space. Not real soon, he says. He chalks a line on the Missoula Strip. She'll have to land short to hit it. Mountain flyers have to know how to land short, he says. He wants her within 50 feet of that chalked line 9 times out of 10. Her ambitions for herself are all about accuracy, precision, steel nerves, the seat of her pants. And there is Barclay McQueen. Trout says I need to get rid of my old instincts and replace them with new ones, she tells him on his porch, delivery basket forgotten at her feet. Because if you do what feels natural, you'll get yourself killed.
I don't follow.
Like, if you're long on approach, you can't just point the nose at the ground because that'll increase the speed and you'll balloon up and away. Or if you didn't turn tightly enough to line up, you can't just add rudder or you'll skid into a spin. Trout says then you might as well aim for the cemetery and save everybody some trouble.
Sounds dangerous.
Of course it's dangerous. When she'd returned for her second lesson with Trout, she had known she was accepting Barclay's patronage, and therefore his presence and also the unanswered question of what he would eventually ask for in return. But, she told herself, even if she hadn't gone back to the airfield, he would have insinuated himself into her life some other way.
You're not afraid? Barclay says.
No, then. Maybe a little sometimes, but it's worth it.
Frankly, I'd prefer you to stay on the ground.
She is afraid he'll say what would seem to follow. He'd prefer her to stay on the ground, and so he will keep her there. But he bites into one of the cream puffs Stanley has sent. A shower of confectioner's sugar speckles his black waistcoat. They have never acknowledged he is paying for her flying. He has never mentioned the message she'd given to Sadler, her plan to pay him back, which she has chosen to take as tacit agreement. She has never told him she knows Wallace's car is in his garage. They have not spoken again of Miss Dolly's. They pretend they have simply struck up a friendship, the delivery girl and the well-heeled cattle rancher. This can't last, this state of congenial denial. The suspense of it weighs on her. She waits, but he only goes on eating the pastry. More sugar clings to his chin. And as she realizes he isn't going to cut off her lessons, she goes giddy with tenderness. She reaches to brush at his chin, but he catches her wrist, stays her hand. Aloft, life is more relentlessly three-dimensional than on the ground. She has to be aware of the plane's three axes, where it is in space, where it will be in another second, another minute. Trout makes her take off and land, take off and land until the regular rise and fall of the horizon, the surge and easing of the engine, begin to feel like functions of her own body. She learns to wallow just shy of a stall, slowing her glide enough that the controls go slack, but not so much that the buoyancy falls out from under her. She learns how to side slip in a crosswind, helpful for short landings, though she's still not close enough to the chalk line most times. She no longer marvels at Missoula's miniature streets and buildings. The city is no more noteworthy than the pattern of a familiar rug. "Enough circles," Trout says one day. "Let's go somewhere." They fly up to Flathead Lake and back. Not far, but somewhere. In her logbook, for the first time, she writes in the notes column, "Cross country." Cross country makes regular appearances. Trout instructs her in navigating by train tracks, roads, and rivers, by the compass and the clock. She keeps a map pinned to one knee, a notepad strapped to the other for jotting calculations. She learns the air is smoothest at dawn and dusk. She learns to always be looking for where she can land if the engine quits. She had not understood the emptiness of Montana, had never quite lost the fanciful idea that once she got up high enough, she would find a magnificent vista onto the rest of the world. So far, she's only found valleys and mountains, trees and trees and trees, the sun's fading stain. She longs for something different. They could be at the ocean in one day's flying, she tells Trout. All in good time, he says. One day, somewhere between Kalispell and Whitefish, he points down at a roof in a valley.
That's Bannockburn.
What's Bannockburn?
I'd have thought you would know. It's the McQueen Ranch.
A big house with chimneys. Forest and mountains and grassy valleys all around it.
How far does the land go? She asks. Oh, I don't know. All this and then some.
Bannockburn, Jamie tells her later, is the name of a poem about a battle the Scots won against the English. He'd read it in school. He finds it for her in a book. Robert Burns. At Bannockburn the English lay. The Scots, they were nae far away, but waited for the break of day. What happened after the battle? She asks Jamie. They were independent, he says, for a while. Now's the day and now's the hour, is the line that lodges in her mind. She stays aloft longer than planned one evening, solo, flies west toward the setting sun. Darkness comes up from behind her. spreads over the dome until only a band of deep, rusty red is ahead of her. When she turns back, the stars have crowded in from behind. Trout gets some of the airfield guys to light up the runway with their headlights so she can land. He's too relieved to be angry, too angry to be relieved.
If you got killed, who do you think he would blame?
He asks her. October leans into November. The trees are tipped with gold, the cottonwoods bright as apricot flesh. The landscape flares and shimmers. Some money goes missing from her nooks and crannies in the cottage. Wallace, of course. She puts the rest in the bank, though it feels strange to deposit her ill-gotten gains in so law-abiding a place. A few of her father's older and more richly illustrated books disappear next, and some of the more obviously valuable knick-knacks. A jade horse, a string of ivory beads carved to filigree.
Where are they? She demands of Wallace in his studio. Who'd you sell them to?
She is certain the answer will be Barclay McQueen. There are no canvases on the easels. He hasn't been painting. As far as she can tell, he hasn't been going to the U either. But she doesn't know if he's been fired or has just stopped showing up. Dust coats the craggy patches of dried paint on his palettes. Wallace is wearing his bathrobe over a collarless shirt, open at the neck, and he is barefoot and hungover and slumped sorrowfully in an armchair, his head resting between thumb and index finger on a propping arm. She stands over him. Jamie skulks in the doorway.
I sent them to a curiosity dealer in New York, Wallace says. Someone I knew when I lived there. The horse was very valuable.
I'll buy it back. How much did you get for it?
He quotes an astronomical sum. She can't buy it back.
It wasn't yours to sell.
Marion, says Jamie, it wasn't really ours either.
She looms over Wallace.
Why don't you make more paintings and sell those? You're supposed to be a painter.
Wallace shrivels into the chair.
I've lost the ability.
No, says Jamie. You just need to go out into the mountains like you used to. Wallace shakes his head.
I've tried. I try, and there's nothing. It's like my painting arm has been amputated.
That can't be, says Jamie.
It's in your head.
Of course it's in my head, says Wallace.
You do it then if it's so simple. I see your little sketches. Go ahead and make paintings people want to buy.
People do buy Jamie's watercolors, Marion says. He sells them in town.
Wallace, even in his shame and dishevelment, summons a dismissive grimace. Now that Jamie's drawings and watercolors have become very good, at least to Marion's eye, Wallace ignores them.
At least I'm trying, Jamie says. At least Marion's trying.
I'm trying too, Wallace says.
I'm sorry if my efforts don't impress you. Did you have a use for that jade horse? Please tell me what it was.
Enough, Marion says. It's done. What did you do with the money?
I needed to settle a few debts. Urgently.
Wallace's cheek is mashed against his palm now, as though his head is growing heavier and heavier.
A few, Marion says. But not all.
No, not all.
She puts a lock on the cottage door. November leans into December. Commander Richard E. Byrd, a navigator famous for flying over the North Pole with pilot Floyd Bennett in 1926, flies over the South Pole. Eventually, after he's dead, a consensus will emerge that he and Bennett probably hadn't actually made it to the North Pole, erased sextant sights in Byrd's diary, unanswerable questions about the plane's maximum speed, the time elapsed. but Bird and his crew really do fly over the gleaming white disk of the polar plateau all the way to the South Pole in a plane named for Bennett, who's dead by then. In Missoula, a browning and dulling, the earth waiting sullenly for snow. A dusting falls, then a thick, smooth skin of white. Trees and rocks show through like abrasions. If the cloud ceiling is too low, Trout will shake his head, send Marion away. Sometimes cloud comes when they're already aloft, layers closing in or walls rising up, blocking the way. Inside there's just gray nothing, she tells Jamie. Sometimes you feel like you don't even exist, or like the world doesn't.
That sounds awful, he says.
But when you come out the other side, everything seems brighter, like a blindfold's been taken off. Sometimes when they emerge, even when she's been concentrating on staying level, the wings are disconcertingly tilted.
I'd know if we banked enough.